The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Last week, on Sunday, I gave a talk about desire. And in the course of the talk, I mentioned something I had read. I don't know if it's true, but people who'd studied the activity, neural activity of the brain, had pointed out the same centers of the brain light up when there's desire as when there is fear. And so that's kind of an interesting idea. Same mechanisms, maybe, same pathways to some degree. And so I thought I would talk about fear today, since we talked about desire last week. You know, logically, there seems to be some connection between desire and fear, in that if you desire something enough, there's danger, there's risk. And danger and risk is one of the things that produces fear. When you desire something a lot, there's the risk of not getting it, of being hurt or disappointed. There's the risk of getting it and then losing it and being hurt, disappointed, anger. And there's also the when you desire something, there's also the fear that can be there of getting what you desire. Because sometimes getting what you want sometimes is quite threatening. So, for example, some of you might know that, you know, you want someone to love you, and then you get it. And that's pretty risky. It was better just to want it. And so desire, you know, logically you can see a connection, perhaps. But last week when I talked about desire, I said that desire is an umbrella term, that we want to be very careful how we use it, and not assume that all desire is bad or all desire is good. But desire is an umbrella term in that it covers a range of different motivations, some of them which are healthy and some of them which are not. And it's important to differentiate. You find sometimes people attribute the teaching in Buddhism that desires are the problem, get rid of your desires. And that does an injustice to what Buddhism actually teaches, because Buddhism is more nuanced. The idea is to become free of those desires which are unhealthy, but not those which are healthy. So the same thing with fear. I like to think of fear as an umbrella term that covers a range of feelings, attitudes, emotions, motivations. And there are healthy fear and unhealthy fear. And sometimes in Buddhist circles, people think that if you are a mature Buddhist practitioner, you'll have no fear whatsoever. And if you're afraid, it's a shortcoming on your part. You're not a successful Buddhist. And so you don't tell anyone or something. That's a wonderful solution. But I think, you know, Buddhism clearly teaches that there are healthy fears to have. And one of those healthy fears is called, as a word, it's called otapa in Pali. And that's the fear of causing harm, fear of transgressing in some ways that causes harm to someone. And so it's a very healthy kind of fear. That fear is called the guardian of the world. So the fact that people have some sense of imagining the consequences of their actions and imagining that if I do this, it might cause harm to others or to myself, and to recoil from that, to pull back from this. I don't want to do this, no way. To have some fear, some apprehension is considered a very healthy kind of fear to have. The fear of death can be quite difficult for people, painful, challenging people to have, very limiting sometimes. Other times the fear of death can be quite motivating and useful to have, because it can motivate us to look more deeply into this life of ours, to look at what's happening when we're afraid, to look at the nature of what this life is that we have. And not a few people have engaged in deep spiritual work by their encounter with the fear of death, being afraid of it. And for example, in my case, that wasn't deep encounter with it, but when I was 20, it was one of the motivating factors that got me involved in Buddhism. I was afraid of death and wanted to looking for something to kind of to deal with that. It was motivating for me to deal with that, because I didn't want to live with that fear. So part of what I think is healthy to do in Buddhism is to have a policy. Policies should always have exceptions, but a policy of turning towards fear, being able to look more carefully at it so we can see what is the nature of this fear And is there something here that I can learn? Is there something here that's useful in this fear? One of the useful things in fear that I've seen is that when certain kinds of fear, especially interpersonal fear or something, can sometimes make us much more honest and real when we feel exposed, when we're afraid. It's usually because we're touching something that is kind of, you know, deep or meaningful for us, some strong desire, some strong worry, some strong sense of how we feel we are in this world, or how we're confused about being in this world in some way. And so by willing to be open to our fear, sometimes we open to a deeper part of who we are, and we can share it with someone else than if we hold a kind of armor and, you know, pretend we're not afraid or don't show that. To show the fear, I think, allows for sometimes much deeper communication with people who can hold your fear respectfully. And there are people that don't, who won't, right? So they have to be careful about who you show your fear to. And then there's all kinds of healthy fear, there's fear of the car coming down the road. And I was walking down, I walked here from home on Sunday mornings, and a couple of times I was thinking about fear, I was giving the talk, and a couple of times I could feel a little knot or a little tension or vibration associated with fear in my stomach as I was walking. And it was when I was walking down the hill, and it was, you know, wet and raining, and there was no sidewalk where I was walking, and I could hear a car approaching me from behind. I couldn't see the car, and I could feel like it was kind of coming kind of fast. And it was a little pang of, oh, what's that about? Is that going to be okay? Maybe I wasn't smart enough to turn around and look, because I have enough confidence in the cars and the drivers to feel it's probably okay. But, you know, I could feel it, and probably that kind of little apprehension around the car is a useful thing to have in places where people often can drive a little bit out of control. One of the things I try to carefully tell my 13-year-old son, preparing him to be a driver, is tell him, you know, you have to be concerned when you drive. Be concerned about the other drivers, and can't just drive as if you're the only driver. So one of the things, when we turn towards fear to look at it, one of the things to look at is, what is our relationship to fear, or all the different kinds of fear that we can have? Do we have a blanket, you know, one set idea, relationship to fear, that all fear is wrong and bad, that all fear, because we're uncomfortable, it represents a shortcoming on my part? You know, I shouldn't really be afraid. Maybe your logical mind knows it's okay to be afraid of some things, but somehow there's an attitude that if you're afraid, something must be wrong with you. And it's very uncomfortable, just because of that judgment that's there. It's one thing to be afraid, it's one thing to judge yourself for being afraid. And then, what are the usual ways in which you respond when you're afraid? A wonderful exercise, I think, is to imagine yourself, maybe remember a time in your life when you had access to absolutely no wisdom at all. And maybe there was once. You were stressed out, you were hungry, tired, upset, everything was going wrong, and, you know, you were just end of your wits, and, you know, there's no wisdom available. And in that kind of situation, if something suddenly made you afraid, or you're afraid, what's your gut reaction to that? What's your instinctual response to it? And different people have different instinctual responses. Maybe different ones at different times, but I think many people have, like, you know, kind of a core one. So, you know, they have the famous fight or flight is supposed to be a response to fear. And part of the function of fear, apparently, is to generate energy for that fight or flight. So, you know, some people attack when they're afraid, or they plunge in. They get angry, or they assign blame. Some people withdraw, pull back, run away, and put their head in the sands or something. Avoid at all costs the problem. But there's others, F words too. There's fight or flight. There's also freeze. And some people, when they get afraid enough, they freeze. They go numb. And they shut down. It can be very difficult. The mind can get very confused and cognitively impaired, and hard to track what's going on, and that freezing kind of stuck kind of thing is one approach some people have. And then there's another wonderful approach, another F word, is forget it. To forget it, which is just override it, just ignore it, just kind of barrel ahead as if it's not really there. And so one way or the other, I call that forgetting, not really listening to it. And I think that that attempt to kind of override it, to barrel through it, to pretend it's not there, to actively kind of override it so it doesn't limit us, sometimes it does us a disservice, because it keeps us from turning inward to really see more deeply what's the nature of this fear, what's going on there. And I would suggest that all your fears are gateways into understanding yourself more deeply. That all your fears are actually valuable for you, because if you're afraid, there's something there for you to look at. Maybe it's not necessary to be afraid, and maybe that's what you'll learn, that there's something deeper that you can work through and understand and clarify so that you don't have fear. Or maybe there is something important in the fear. Maybe it's something so important that maybe it's going to change how you want to live your life. You have to listen to it in some way and do something differently. So how is it for you? Are you the fear type? Are you the flight? Fight? Frozen? Or forgetting type? Which way do you approach it? Sometimes it has to do with how intense it is. Sometimes when it gets quite intense, it can morph from one to the other. So then part of the value of something like mindfulness practice is to help us turn towards something like fear to take a deeper look at it. And I think one of the great strengths of mindfulness is teaching us, mindfulness practice is teaching us how to be present for any emotion at all while doing two things simultaneously. Really seeing that it's there, kind of taking kind of in some sense responsibility for it being there, being present for it, feeling it, looking at it, at the same time as not identifying with it too strongly. It's taking responsibility but no identification, which means that you're willing to look at it, try to understand it, try to be responsible for it, but at the same time you don't get wrapped up in using it to define who you are as a way of judging and measuring, this is who I am. I'm a bad person because I'm afraid. And so a willingness to kind of almost be like be a naturalist who looks at our emotional life like a naturalist would look at wildlife in nature. A naturalist, supposedly, the way I think of it is, would go into nature and doesn't interrupt or disturb what's in nature, but just watches in order to learn what is there. The mountain, they're watching, and they see the mountain lion coming to attack the deer. It's kind of tragic. But a naturalist would just watch that because that's part of nature to see. The naturalist sees this beautiful bunny rabbit. It doesn't take it home. But rather just leaves it there to observe more carefully. So the same thing could be, to be a naturalist of your own life, to have that equanimous or that kind of little bit distant relationship where you're not entangled with it, not manipulating, not trying to fix it, is part of the training of mindfulness practice. And this is particularly useful with fear, because fear is, unless the mountain lion's attacking you right now, but even then, you can make an argument for this. Most fear has to do with the imagination, the ideas of what's going to happen in the future. And so part of fear is being caught or up in ideas, concepts, thoughts. And that's also part of the trap of working with fear is... You can have the idea that fear is the problem and there's a solution to being not afraid. And if you can do the right thing, you will have the right solution sometime in the future. And so there's a gap between what you want to have happen and what's actually happening. And it's fine to have that gap. It's fine to have a goal. But if you have too much caught up in trying to change who you are to attain the imaginary goal, then you're being disrespectful sometimes of what's happening now. And sometimes some people will add the idea that because I'm not the ideal I'm trying to attain, what's happening now is wrong and bad, and so they're at, and then because of that, they're kind of at war with themselves. They're kind of little bit kind of trying to get rid of the fear, getting rid of the bad feeling they have or the attitude or whatever's going on. They're trying to push it away or do something with it in a way that just ties the knot tighter. We're caught up with something. And as we think what's happening now is wrong, we can be at war with ourselves, the very war that makes the fear stronger. So one of the things about mindfulness practice is it's fine to have an idea that you're trying to get somewhere, like to be free of fear, if the fear is a problem. But you want to be very careful that you don't set up this gap between what you're trying to do and where you are now, where you're at fighting against what's happening now, trying to push it away or blast it out of existence or, you know. So a very important part of mindfulness practice then is learning to turn towards what you're actually feeling and allowing it to be as it is. And that can be hard with fear because fear is often motivating for fear and flight or freeze or forget. And so how to turn towards it and be present, especially when it's strong. So part of mindfulness practice then involves taking the time, and it might take a long time, to learn to slowly find out how to bring presence, mindfulness, to our fear. To, you know, maybe first you do it from a distance. Sometimes I've given people instructions to don't go right into the middle of your fear and feel it fully, completely. Imagine that you're a bird sitting on a tree 300 yards away. And from there, you look at yourself being afraid. And sometimes when you have that kind of distance, people say, then I can, then it's safe to feel my fear. Because there's kind of some distance. And maybe you get little dosages of the fear. And then pull away. Go for a walk. Go back and feel it. Pull away. Go back and feel it. Pull away. Until you have the ability to feel the fear without reacting to it, without getting triggered by more fear, so you spiral of panic, without getting triggered into being aversive and angry with yourself or upset or embarrassed, or there's many attitudes people can have towards fear that can get in the way. And the aim, what we're trying to do in mindfulness practice, is learn how, when there's fear, is learn how to be present for fear as if the fear has permission to be there. As if it's okay to be afraid. It's not an easy thing to come to, but it's extremely powerful because at that moment, when fear, when it's okay to be afraid, when your mindfulness is strong enough, equanimous enough, balanced enough to be present for fear, when it's okay to be afraid, at that moment, you're not caught by the fear. By that time, you are being mindful of the fear, you're relating towards the fear is not running you. The fear doesn't have the upper hand. And that is a wonderful moment to sit there and kind of be present and feel, I'm afraid, but it's okay. So I'm afraid, but I'm not the fear. I'm afraid, but I have some ability to choose and decide what to do here based on what's going on. So one of the approaches to developing this, especially when the fear is strong, anxiety can be strong, is to, you know, come to it briefly. Touch it, pull back, touch it, pull back. Because it can be too much just to go into it directly. Another approach is to begin looking more carefully at what makes up the fear. Because fear is a composite. In the wonderful, you know, Buddhism has this Abhidharma, which has this wonderful list of mental factors, depending on, you know, it's all these, you know, the mind is made up of all these mental functionings, and they have particular lists of them. But in the different list of mental functionings or factors, fear is not part of it. And so the question is, well, aren't Buddhists afraid? And I think the reason it doesn't appear there is that fear is a composite. It's made up of different elements. And I know one school of therapy that gives people an exercise called the Can Monster exercise when people are afraid. And this is, apparently, my son has one of these. He got it recently. My son looks like a budding engineer. And so for his birthday, he got this kit. The only thing we had to supply to the kit was a soda can. And it had all these, he was making a soda can robot. And so it had these, you attach these arms, and you screw these arms on, and wheels, and a battery, and a switch, and I don't know what. And this soda can kind of walks around the living room with his arms kind of the rubber bands and all these things kind of going. So the can monster exercise is you is it fear, the argument is fear is made up, it's like a can monster, it's made up of rubber bands and screws and tape and all these different things. But if we look at fear from a distance too much or as a whole, it can look really frightening. But if you actually look more carefully, you see it's just made up of rubber bands and springs and screws and tape. I mean, my son makes things with a lot of tape. So we keep having to buy tape at home because the tape's like this. For young engineers, it seems like a great... And so to look and see, what is fear made up of? And then, so it's made up of many things. So we in our Buddhist tradition, we talk about the four foundations of mindfulness. And the four foundations of mindfulness are four areas with which to tease apart the composite elements of fear. There's other ways of doing this, but kind of our way, one way, is to do this way. One is to look at how it is experienced in the body. And fear will almost always be manifest in the body some way or other, in the stomach, in the chest, in the hands, in the face, and the heart. Start racing. Start sweating. there's many ways in which it might appear. And so to feel it in the body, see the physical aspect of it, one of the values of that is that it's usually uncomfortable in the body, and some of the ways that we get reactive to fear has to do with the discomfort we have physically. And if we can feel the physical discomfort, we're less likely to be caught by the automatic reactions that might come out of that physical aspect. Also, the body to feel something in the body is a wonderful stepping stone to help us with this disidentification, to kind of step back and not define our identity, who I am by it, but just let it be a physical phenomena as it's there. Also, when we feel it in the body, I think of the body as being kind of like mindfulness of the body as being kind of like a making space, making breathing room for us. And so when you feel something in the body, it can begin to dissolve or unfold or evolve in ways. If we stay caught up in the story and the ideas we have about what we're afraid of, the body is often ignored, and so then the stories will generate more tension or nervousness in the system. But if we can drop out of the story into the body, it sometimes helps with a softening and relaxing with it all. Also, the body is always in the present moment. The things we're afraid of usually are not. So the body is a useful thing. Part of the mindfulness of the body is mindfulness of breathing. And many of you know that attention to your breathing, just breathing in a rhythmic, easy way, is one way to lessen panic. And I've known lots of people who have been in panic attacks, and the instruction is breathe deeply. It happened to me once. So the very first interview, meditation meeting I had with the meditation teacher, with my Zen teacher when I was in my early 20s, it was the first time I was going to have a formal meeting, this Dokusan, one-on-one. And we went into this room, he's sitting there in this formal Buddha posture, you know. And I had to sit down in front of him. He's like, oh, he's pretty close together, you know, like I'm not used to being so close and so intimate, so direct with people. It's better to look at people from an angle, right? But it's safer. But there, like, we're there, facing each other in this room alone. And I was so nervous, I couldn't speak. And so he said to me, "Gil, breathe deeply." And as I breathed deeply, and then I think I don't remember what happened after that, but we might probably talked, but maybe it didn't make any impression because of the fear. So breathe deeply. So, you know, paying attention to the breath can be very helpful. The other next foundation of mindfulness is the feeling tone. Is it comfortable or uncomfortable what's happening? And it's remarkable how much of our life is a reaction to whether we're comfortable or uncomfortable. And so just learning to clearly identifying, oh, this is really uncomfortable, sometimes can save us a lot of extra work, a lot of reactivity. Just uncomfortable. What do you think of this? Oh, it's just uncomfortable. As opposed to the whole story that's connected to it. I'm just uncomfortable. And then there's the called the mind state, the emotional state that's going on. There's, you know, what's going on in your mind as you're afraid. One of the things going on in the mind is the stories that you have. And there's a huge benefit of beginning to track what you actually believe when you're afraid. Do you know what you're believing? Many years ago, I did some therapy, and the therapist asked me a whole series of questions, all the same question, over and over again. See, I said I was worried that something was going to happen. So if that happens, what are you afraid is going to happen? So I said something, and the therapist said, "And if that happens, what are you afraid of?" And so I thought for a while, and then I said something else. "Well, if that happens, what are you afraid of?" I thought about it for a while. As they kept asking the questions, like going deeper and deeper, it turned out that the original fear was just a surface fear, that deep down, you know, was something else. I think back then, I don't remember anymore, so long ago, but I believe it had something to do with fear of rejection. And it took a while, layers, to get it down. Oh, that's what I'm afraid of, to be rejected. And so what do you believe? And what do you believe is important for you in your life? What do you believe about your identity? What do you believe about the relationship other people have to you? What are your subconscious, perhaps, beliefs about the role other people's judgments of you are? You know, the fact that someone criticizes you or doesn't like you. What do you believe the importance of that is? Is it that important that someone doesn't like you? Maybe it depends on who it is. But have you ever examined your attitude towards other people's opinions about you? Examine it, look at that. And perhaps, I think really a wise approach to life is to loosen up a lot about what other people think about you. It just gets in the way of a lot of different things. It doesn't mean that you become callous and ignore your effect on people. You should not hurt people. But what they think of you sometimes is a surefire way of getting trapped, to be concerned, trying to make sure everyone kind of thinks of you just the right way. There could be very deep-seated beliefs, but what we think is the most important values or most important things to have in life that triggers fear. Are these things that important? It's a great story. I have no idea if it's a true story, but it's told in our circles. It's an old Japanese story, supposedly, of some samurai or soldiers are coming through town, creating havoc. Maybe it was wartime. And they're, you know, fighting and killing people. And all the monks of some monastery run away because the samurais are coming to town. and except the old abbot. And he sits there at the entrance of a temple in meditation posture. And the samurai runs up to him and says, holds his sword up and says, "What are you doing here? Why aren't you running away? Don't you know who I am?" And the master, "Well, who are you?" "I'm someone who could run you through with this sword without blinking an eye." And the abbot looks at him and says, "And I'm a person who can be run through, who can be run, can have a sword run through me without blinking an eye." And so, as these stories go, the samurai became the abbot's student. But you know, the fear of death, to examine carefully, what do we believe? What are the beliefs that come into play when we're afraid of death? Not a few people, what they're afraid of when they're afraid of death is not death itself, but the pain that might come with that dying. And so then if you really can identify specifically that's the fear, then you can maybe address that fear. Try to understand something about palliative care, about pain or something. And then the final foundation of mindfulness has a lot to do with this issue of our relationship to what's happening. So are we relating to our fear with clinging? Some people actually cling to fear. Even if they hate it, there's a kind of clinging involved. Some people depend on fear to be motivated to do things. There's a lot of reasons why people hold on to it. Or are you aversive to it? Are you pushing away? Are you afraid of your fear? Do you get confused when there's fear? And that's, you know, your relationship. Do you shut down? Sloth and torpor. That's one approach to being afraid, is to just go to sleep. Or does it, you kind of start running in circles? Do you get agitated? So that's called the five hindrances. So what's your relationship to it? Or do you have inner strengths that you can call upon to relate to the fear through the avenue of those strengths? Have you developed your capacity to be mindful? Have you developed your capacity to investigate and look more deeply, look at what's going on? Have you developed your capacity to be persistent, to keep up, to keep going, not giving up because of fear? It's a capacity, the capacity of persistence, patience. Have you developed a capacity to feel some joy in this life, some joy in being mindful, some joy in being present? Have you developed a capacity for relaxation, for concentration? Because one of the great challenges, one of the great kind of causes of fear or aggravators of fear is stress and being tense. And so learning to relax. Do you know anything about relaxation? You know how to relax. Do you know how to use meditation? Do you know how to relate to your body? Do you know how to do progressive relaxation of your body? It's a beautiful thing to learn. To learn to go inside our body and find, where am I tense? Can I soften my belly? Can I soften my thighs? Can I relax my hands? Where is the holding? And taking time to do that. We have developed a capacity for that. And then the final of these strengths that's listed in the fourth foundation is the capacity to be equanimous. Some people translate that to being accepting of the situation. But it be equanimous, to not be pushed around by the fear, to be kind of balanced, to be generous towards the fear, to give it permission to be there without being agitated, without shutting down, without being for and against it. Just let it be there. And if you can learn how to really be with fear well and deeply, you'll probably learn about some of the most deepest thing aspects of who you are. They say that one of the deepest forms of fear is connected to our fear around our self-identity, fear of self, fear of losing self. I would venture to say that fear is so important that any spiritual tradition that doesn't frighten you is not doing his job. Or if you do any spiritual practice long enough, if at some point you don't run up against fear, go talk to someone, go talk to a teacher or someone, and look at what you're missing. If you think that spiritual life is only about floating on clouds and bliss, and I don't think you understand how profound the inner transformation, inner work can be. And as any, it's to go into something unknown, it's going into the deepest attachments we have, to take a leap of faith into something really you can't know, to take certainly the path of Buddhism. And that leap into the unknown, that transformation, that letting go of some of the deepest attachments we have, very commonly produces fear in people. That fear is not a mistake. It's not a sign of shortcoming that you have. It's a sign that something important is moving through you, is happening. And so if you have spent your time training yourself to learn how to be with fear in the ordinary circumstances of daily life, learning how to be wise with it, mindful of it, independent from it, then when you face some of the big fears that come with a spiritual life, or the big fear maybe when you're going to die, you'll be prepared. And that'll be good. So may you have good fear. And may this talk inspire you to take a more closer look at how fear operates in your life. Unless you're one of those people who, of course, has no fear, then do something else. Thank you.